Studio 360.
This hour, we are talking about excellent things creative people make that expand our minds when we're kids, and which we keep falling in love with all over again as adults. So far, we've looked at typically indoor pursuits, watching television and reading. Now we're taking it outside to examine another staple of kid culture, the playground.
I am approaching the wall of blocks to climb up it to get to the slide. There's a bunch of children.
Wow, it's so long!
This person, pointing out the children, is Paul, who is giving us a first-hand account of what it's like to go down a 57-foot-long slide, the longest in New York City.
I'm placing my cardboard on the slide. I'm getting on the slide. And I'm going. That's all from Paul's slide.
You probably guessed that Paul is not a radio professional. He's 11 years old. His mother is Alexandra Lang. She is an architecture and design critic and author of the terrific new book, The Design of Childhood. And since we wanted to talk about playgrounds, Alexandra and I got together one fine day this summer at one of New York's newest playgrounds on Governor's Island in the harbor. So, Alexandra, when did playgrounds show up? When we kind of invented the idea of childhood?
Well, yes, there's a lot of debate about when, let's say, modern childhood was invented. But in terms of
1883, okay.
No, in terms of playgrounds, they first came to Boston in the 1880s. Some of the women who ran settlement houses in Boston saw what were called sand gardens in Germany, which were basically like a vacant lot filled with sand that would be installed in an urban setting, often in the summer when kids were out of school and needed something to do. So she brought this idea to Boston and put a sand garden in a poor neighborhood, and it was a big hit. And so the settlement houses began to see that as part of their agenda, you know, helping immigrants families, they also needed to help the children and give them a place to be, a place to play that wasn't the streets. And so the sand gardens then in the early part of the 20th century led to public parks that had playgrounds with actual equipment, you know, often metal equipment. Some of those parks would have a park house, they would have exercise classes. There was really a whole charity movement towards play and getting children active in cities as a way of often of keeping them from, I don't know, dirty tricks.
Well, right. And there, if your whole thing is playgrounds of a certain design sort, you fall into the problem that urban renewal people fell into in the 50s and 60s that Jane Jacobs had to say, wait, stop. It's okay as it is. Don't tear it all down and make it a big tower. Stickball is good.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And actually, it was funny. So, I mean, the playgrounds that a lot of people, I would say, especially baby boomers, probably grew up with, had metal structures over asphalt. And, you know, you really very rarely see those anymore. But I went up to Van Cortlandt Park to the Cloisters with my family recently, and we ran across one of those climbing structures that was probably put in by Robert Moses in the 1940s, just a metal three-dimensional grid.
Jungle gym.
Yes, a jungle gym, classic jungle gym. And of course my kids went nuts for it, and I took a picture and posted it on Twitter, and I got like 200 responses because there's an amazing sort of waves of nostalgia when people see childhood objects. And you really don't, like, I mean, that jungle gym should be in a museum. Like, it is an important piece of design. There isn't so much wrong with it. I mean, I know because I've done this reading why they got rid of jungle gyms over asphalt. But on the other hand,
because what, kids knocked their heads on against the bar and
yeah, in the early 1980s, they put in a series of safety regulations in response to a set of lawsuits for, among other things, kids falling off the top of slides sideways. And they really focused on the distance of falls, because that was where kids broke their arms or, you know, in more terrible cases, broke their skulls. So that's why you almost never see play equipment now that's not over wood chips, sand, or those squishy tiles that we have on most of the New York City playgrounds. And that's also why most climbing structures don't go straight up and down. Like, from the top of one of those jungle gyms, you could fall straight down for 6 or 7 feet. And if you look at climbing structures today, they're designed so that if you fall, you're likely to hit something else on the way down that you can grab onto. So you don't have that kind of straight shot down. These are smart things. Like, we don't want children to get hurt.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I think now we've gone too far and children aren't getting hurt, but they're also not being challenged, and then they don't want to go play.
Right. And as a mother, do you ever, you get, of course, why parents, don't want their kids to break their arms or worse.
Yes.
But are you ever, as you have become an ideologue for risk, are you ever torn?
Yeah, of course. It's hard to let your kids go. You want them to be independent. You want them to have their own minds. But then you see them, on a big rock in Van Cortlandt Park, and you think, is she going to fall? Like, does she know what she's doing? And that's hard. But if you don't let your child take that risk, they don't get the reward of the satisfaction of getting up that rock.
Couldn't agree with you more. One sees some playgrounds, contemporary playgrounds, where, instead of just a jungle gym, it's a rocket ship, or it's instead of a slide, it's a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Which always seems a little cheesy to me. Those are controversial, right?
Yes.
In your fancy design world.
Yes, I agree. It's cheesy. No, it's just not necessary. Kids, it goes back to, kind of cardboard box play even. Like, why tell a kid, what the box is? Why tell a kid what the climbing structure is? Let them decide what it's going to be that day. And if you put little wings and a point on it and say it's a rocket ship, then, they can ignore it, but they may only feel that they can play a space game in that piece of climbing equipment. And who needs that? That in a way seems to me to be kind of subscribing to some adult idea about what kid things look like, and kids are fine with abstraction. Their imagination fills in the blanks.
Yeah, you in the book create this typology of the sort of forces at play in playground design, and the abstractionists being one of them.
So the abstractionists are people like Osamu Noguchi, the sculptor, who, it turns out, spent about 60 years of his art career trying to build a playground that kind of, again, looks like abstract sculpture.
As his furniture and his lighting do, too.
Yes, yes. So he started designing them in the 1930s, and they were quite influential because they were exhibited at MoMA. They were in all the magazines. A lot of important people like Thomas Hess, who was the editor of Art in America at the time, backed them, but he couldn't get one built in New York. He tried and tried. There's one Noguchi playground in Piedmont Park in Atlanta, and I went on a journey to Sapporo in the north of Japan to see his last work, which was the one place that a really giant Noguchi playground was made. And that has pyramids, it has slides that look like mountains, all of these things that are just really aesthetically beautiful, but are also challenging play experiences. It was a bit tragic that I couldn't bring my children with me because of school and expense, but I played on all the play equipment by myself in Japan, and it was pretty awesome.
Alexandra Lang's new book, The Design of Childhood, is out now. Zoe Saunders and Tommy Bazarian produced that story.